Good morning and welcome to Jonesy, the show that brings you conversations with some of the most interesting people in the world of books, podcasts, radio, theater, music, food, and humor, guaranteed to entertain and enlighten. I'm the host of Jonesy, Ken Jones. No relation, by the way. On today's episode, we're celebrating the launch of the new anthology, Soul Jar, 31 fantastical tales by disabled authors from Forest Avenue Press. We're fortunate to have with us the collection's editor, Annie Carl, and two of those 31 contributors, Ellis Bray and Simon Quinn. The 31 tales in Soul Jar feature pickpockets turned crime fighters, apocalyptic viruses, vengeful books, dragons, sorrow stealers, necromancers, spellcasters, diabetic zombie fighters, alien detectives, shape-shifting therapists, ghosts, imaginary friends, geyser pterosaurs, frozen ponds that swallow children, and demons raised from cereal box toys. In the words of author Violet Lumani, Soul Jar is a fantastical bullhorn for voices that so often go unheard. Vibrant characters come alive, navigating a range of experiences and emotions while simultaneously illuminating the impact representation in literature can have. The stories in this extraordinary anthology will pull you in, show you a vastly underexplored area of the literary world, and leave you wanting more. Please join us for our conversation with Annie, Ellis, and Simon, which is already in progress. Annie, Ellis, and Simon, thanks so much for joining us in the KBOO studios.
Thanks for having us, Ken.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now, Annie, there's a blurb for the new book from Portland author Mo Davio. She wrote, "For those of us with bodies that look and function differently than the majority, reading science fiction and fantasy can be a means of feeling understood and seen, or being ever closer to a world that is more welcoming than the real one." Now, you were born with a spinal birth defect, so disabled from birth. Did you read science fiction and fantasy when you were growing up?
Yes. Yes, I did. A did lot it of it.
Sort of that purpose that Mo was getting to?
Well, kind of, yeah. So I grew up about 8 or 9. I discovered my parents' bookcase. It was a shelf in the basement. And it had all of my parents' books from the 60s, 70s, 80s. And so I was growing up on Dune, Stranger in a Strange Land, yes. The Last Unicorn, Lord of the Rings. These were all my parents' copies. My dad was more fantasy, so I have his edition of The Last Unicorn from 1968, 69. And it's this teeny little mass market. If you buy it now, it's like this huge, like, trade paper size book. But it's teeny little mass market with tiny little font. Like, you can't really read it. So these were the books that I was discovering at an early age. And yes, I think Mo has a really good point. But I also, at a certain point in my reading life, discovered that I wasn't actually in these books. Disabled people weren't really featured in these books. Now, there were certain authors like Ursula K. Le Guin who featured gender differences, Left Hand of Darkness being the most well-known one. And some of the other authors did that as well. But they really stuck with the, no offense, Ken, cishet white male gaze in science fiction and fantasy.
No,
and
no
this science fiction. Yeah, right.
We've had our day.
Right. You know, and so that was really what I was reading and what was forming my thoughts and ideas at a young age. And I grew up in Kingston, Washington, small town girl. Love it there. And I went through the children's section in the library real fast. And my parents bought us books all the time, and I still wasn't seeing myself in books. And I wasn't really tracking on that until I got much older. But yes, I really cut my teeth on a lot of the sci-fi fantasy classics.
Yeah, you say in the introduction that even though it didn't feature anybody but the cishet white male, mm-hmm. that you lived in the worlds of fantasy and science fiction, and as a child recovering from operation after operation, mm-hmm. you wrote, "These places and characters took me away from my reality."
Yes.
And it's great that you brought up Ursula Le Guin. I have a quote from her. I did an interview on the previous anthology from Forest Avenue Press, mm-hmm. Dispatches from Inaris.
Oh, I love that
book. Which is kind
of
a tribute to Ursula.
Yeah.
And she said, "As for the charge of escapism," which a lot of people say about fantasy and science fiction, mm-hmm. "what does escape mean? Escape from real life, responsibility, order, duty, piety is what the charge implies. But nobody escapes to jail. The direction of escape is toward freedom, which I love. Mm-hmm. Sci-fi and fantasy is running toward something, freedom in this case, mm-hmm. and rather than running away from reality.
Yes. At an event I did last night, I got a question about why science fiction and fantasy? Why science fiction and fantasy for this anthology? And speculative writers, since back to Epic of Gilgamesh, have been speculating about where humanity is headed. And so the attendee last night asked, well, you know, where are you headed? Where are people with disabilities headed? And I was like, the same place everyone else is? Hopefully not to a dystopic future where we burn the earth to a crisp. But it was a really interesting, and they didn't really read sci-fi or fantasy. And so they were really curious about speculative writers and fantasy writers and about why we decided to set these stories in those worlds. And I think it's really important that, especially right now, when we're seeing a lot of, like, a huge bump in technology, AI and CRISPR and gene editing, and are disabled people being included in with that science? And largely no. Largely no, which is really concerning to me, because we deserve to live in the future as well. So this Soul Jar, this anthology, is sort of the answer to these scientists that are just bombing forward in a way that, cool, yeah, genetically modified humans? Cool. I have nerve damage that maybe I'd like to have fixed if they figure out how to fix it. I'm 85% deaf in my right ear because of nerve damage from hydrocephalus. Do I like how they're going about it? No, because they're not engaging with the disabled community and asking us if we really want this. A lot of people will probably say yes. A lot of people will probably say no. A lot of people will be in the middle, the majority, I think, because it's a really conflicting question. Yeah.
So, and the disabled are a minority, but apparently a very large one.
We are.
In the
actually
books
not,
forward.
Yeah, right.
Nicola Griffith, actually, she quotes a CDC mm-hmm. statistic that 1/4 of Americans have a disability mm-hmm. that has a serious impact on their life. You wrote a book before this through Microcosm Press, Annie, called My Tropey Life, How Pop Culture Stereotypes Make Disabled Lives Harder.
Yeah.
And you talked about it. You don't see yourself, and of course the disabled aren't writing the stories that a lot of us are consuming through
right.
pop culture.
Right.
Nicola goes on to say in that foreword, ableism is the story all of us disabled and non-disabled are fed from birth, that to have intellectual or physical impairments makes us less other. Mm-hmm. It's the only story we get because we don't see any other story either in real life or on TV, in comics or books. Ableism is a crap story. For one thing, it's wrong. What disables a person in our culture is not impairment, but society's attitude to that impairment, which was eye-opening for me to read.
Largely agree. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Yes, more people are disabled and intersectional with other minorities than a lot of the population in Western culture might think. So Western culture, I would include parts of Europe, U.S., Canada, parts of Mexico, anywhere that, yeah, Western culture. Any other country that identifies as Western culture. And I think that stems back to, we're going way back centuries and centuries to when humanity lived in tribes and babies like me did not survive. You know, we'd be born and we would be born, it would be a stillbirth or we would be killed by the tribe because we would slow the tribe down. And since that point in time, we've either been hidden away or institutionalized. Was it you that talked about Ellis? I'm pointing at Ellis. that talked about institutionalization, or was that Cormick?
I think it was Cormick.
Was it Cormick?
Yeah.
So
he was institutionalized?
No. But on Tuesday, he talked about institutionalization and forced institutionalization that is still going on. It's 2023, people.
The disability that I write about in the anthology and the one that I deal with on a daily basis is a mental health diagnosis called bipolar 1, which is popularized, I put that in heavy air quotes, as this essentially monstrous disease that makes people either, makes them chaotic. But as a teenager, I was institutionalized as punishment by my parents. And they would use that as their reasoning for why it should be okay, why I should be put aside. Whether I was having an episode or not, having that diagnosis was a good enough reason to put me in the hospital and out of their hands, for out of their, make me not their problem for 1 to 2 weeks at a time. So while that's more of a child abuse issue, the fact that it's something that can still be done to fledgling adults because of a diagnosis, whether they're having an active health crisis or not, I feel like that played really well into Cormac's point about, you know, it's still going on. This was in 2003, and, you know,
Yeah, and in your bio, Alice, it says that your fiction actually focuses on living with disabilities. In parentheses, you say visible and invisible.
So I have...
And the lasting effects of childhood trauma, which you experienced. Yes, sadly.
Yeah, so the childhood trauma thing comes up all the time just because it's something that I'm going to be dealing with for the rest of my life. But the bipolar disorder is more genetic, I believe, than childhood abuse-based. And the visible disabilities, I get migraines that look like strokes. So when that happens, I use a cane. I've been to the ER more times than I can count because my face is drooping and I'm slurring my words and I can't remember, I can't talk. And concerned people have thought I was having a stroke. So while migraines, especially for people who have them chronically, are disabling, I don't consider them necessarily one of my
major disabilities,
but they are visible when they're happening. They're nothing like, for example, what, I'm so sorry, Annie, I just totally forgot your name.
Fine.
Oh, we can take it from the beginning of word difficulties.
Well,
this is my first time meeting Simon.
Yes.
And my second time meeting Ellis, even though we've been in contact for two-ish years now. Yeah. This is our first time everyone meeting, which is
exciting.
A really big deal. Yeah.
And I should mention, this will air afterwards, but you'll be at Powell's tonight for the book launch, too.
Yeah,
so that's exciting, too.
Yes. And I'm meeting more authors there. I've been in touch with all of the authors as the editor, of course. But this is my first time meeting everyone. I'm a little nervous. I'll say that.
You don't come across that way at all. You're totally chill.
So masking, which it goes hand in hand with disabilities, my masking skills are on par. So I'm actually really nervous right now. Mm-hmm. I've had a nervous stomach all day. It's been awful.
Because of the launch tonight?
The launch tonight, but also meeting everyone. Meeting people is hard for me because I've been strongly judged my entire life. So I was diagnosed with lepomeningeal at 2 weeks old. And so my entire life has been full of judgments, and kids are mean, man. Children are horrible. So in school,
that's for sure. You don't have to have a spinal birth defect.
No,
to get
you don't
teased as a kid.
No.
Any kind of difference, anything at all.
Anything at all, yeah. My kid is having his own kid issues right now, too. So he came home the other day. Mommy, my friend doesn't want to be my friend anymore. Oh, okay. How do we handle that? You know, so growing up this way, and a lot of our authors have grown up that way as teenagers or from birth, or society is not kind to the other. I'm using heavy air quotes there. If your other, Western culture especially is really hard
again,
on the
other.
Again,
it's that tribalism that
yes,
you mentioned before.
Yes, it is.
Now, Simon, your bio in the book describes you as, quote, an autistic trans gay man who loves Hamlet, maybe a little too much. What were
so
the signs
much.
Growing up of the autism, and how did it affect your own sense of self? I assume you also went through this gauntlet of teasing and bullying, maybe.
It was, what's wild, too, is I Kids are mean. This is very true. I didn't know that until I was 20 because I thought that. And part of that is because I'm so autistic. I am also physically disabled, but by the time, but when I sent in my bio, I didn't know that. So I do walk with a cane as well. And I have a host of other things. I have a really bad stutter and just random things. But with my autism, growing up, I didn't, like, so I'm not, there's a stereotype for trans people where they know from early on. It was not me. I didn't figure it out till I was about 17, 18. And so growing up, I learned how to mask as a woman. So now that I've transitioned, I don't have that. I don't know how to do that anymore. Which is, there's pros and cons to that too, because it makes my disabilities much more obvious and my autism a lot more obvious when I talk to people, when I'm interacting. But at the same time, growing up, I wanted to be a librarian. I'm not a librarian, but...
Why was that? Because you took refuge in books, or...?
Yeah. And I was very quiet, so I dressed to be a librarian. And I would have kids, and my classmates would always be like, you look like a school principal, you look like a librarian. That's what I was aiming for. So... I was like, yeah, this is a compliment. I realized when I was telling that story, I was around 20, I told that story and I went, oh, they were making fun of me. And it was just like, oh, yeah.
That there's the stereotypical librarian with the glasses and dresses very bland. And I don't think that is true to reality.
I wore a lot of geometric old movies.
Yeah.
I've always had glasses, though. I had them, well, not always. I got them in third grade, but I
got them about the same time. Yeah.
I am like, it's really bad. That is one that is, I consider that one of my disabilities, because if I don't have them, I can't see more than like 5 inches in front of my face. Wow. Which is, it's like, oh, it's like about right there.
Well, I have 3 prescriptions here. I'm wearing computer glasses where I can see a little closer, and I've got bifocals, so
right.
I know the vision problems.
And I'm going to take that and run with it, because there are certain disabilities that are normalized in our society.
Like vision?
Like wearing glasses. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a very normal thing for people to wear glasses. My husband wears glasses. How many? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 people in this room. There's only 2 of us in the room right now that are.
He wears glasses.
But you wear glasses.
He just doesn't wear them regularly.
Yeah. So I'm the only one in the room who doesn't wear glasses. That's one of the things about me, because I have multiple disabilities as well. I have perfect vision. Woo! Yep.
Kind of your superpower.
It's my superpower, yeah.
You almost had a bingo, but then you lost on the glasses.
Right, right.
No, anyway, I want to get to the book. You're the editor.
I'm the editor,
but also the creator of the book.
Yeah.
In the introduction, you tell the story of how the idea came to you. You were attending your first bookseller trade show. You own and run a bookstore in Edmonds.
I do.
Hosted by the Pacific Northwest Booksellers Association. I think this was October 2017.
Yes.
And one of the sessions was a panel on diversity in indie independent bookstores.
Yeah.
And that panel turned out to be a flashpoint for you.
It was, yes. So I went to this was my first trade show ever as a bookseller. I've been a bookseller since I was 15. I am 39. That tells you my longevity in the industry. I love it with every fiber of my being. Books are where it's at, people. Anyway, so I had opened my store, the Neverending Bookshop, at the end of 2015, and ran it as a used bookstore until 2017, when I started bringing in new books, late 2016. And I signed up with PNBA as a member, and with ABA, the American Booksellers Association. And I went to the first trade show ever, and I didn't know anyone. So I was kind of, but people knew who I was, because I had left a job at Third Place Books to open my store. And I could have happily stayed at Third Place, but I didn't want to. I wanted to try something new. And so I show up at this show, and I didn't know anyone, but people knew me. And that was real weird, let me tell you. Someone called me Notorious at one point, and I was like,
wow, you're a celebrity.
Whoa, I don't know who you are. And so a self-education day has always been my favorite day because I'm a single owner. I don't have any employees. So going to panels is really helpful for educating myself in different things in bookselling and bookstore owning. And so I went to this panel and it was great. It was actually really, really good for everything but disabilities. And at the end, I think I say this in the introduction, before they even got to like, hey, it's the Q&A now, I was like, hey, my arm is raised very high right now. Hey, hi, hey, what do you have about disabilities? And they had nothing, absolutely nothing. And they didn't even have like any websites or resources. No one on the panel was disabled, as far as I could tell. Now, possibly they had invisible disabilities, neurodivergence. This was at a point where neurodivergence was kind of starting to be a thing. I'm using heavy air quotes there because it's always been a thing. We're just talking about it now. And I kept pressing them. I actually cornered one of the panelists after they were like all packed up and was like, no, really? And they were like, I don't know. But at this panel, there was this very special person, and that was Laura Stanfill.
Yes, kind of the universe sent Laura to you, huh?
Yep, Laura, who owns Forest Avenue Press, who is our publisher for Soul Jar. And she came hustling over to me as I'm packing up all my stuff, and so we all know the old adage from Hulk, I'm always angry, right? So I went through a period in my teens where I had a lot of anger issues. And I took it out a lot on my mom. Sorry, Mom, I love you. and my family in general, because they're the safe space, right? I'm very close with my parents and my sister. And so, but I stuffed it down for college. And it was always kind of right in here. I'm gesturing to my midsection. But I kept it to a dull roar. And then this panel happened, and it just went whoosh right out of my head, like the Pixar movie where it's the angry guy and he has the fire coming out of his head.
And Laura sensed that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and she came over, and I'm like shoving my stuff in my bag, and I'm really grumpy about it. She's like, "Hi, I'm Laura Stanfill. We need to talk." And we became friends. That was the moment. Like, I've never friended someone so hard in my life. It was amazing, and so. In the summer of 2020, I was doing some work for a nonprofit that helped disabled youth with the job market. And so I was doing some content for them about entrepreneurship. And I was interviewing other disabled people that I knew, like Joe Beal at Microcosm. Yes. And Laura at Forest Ave about their entrepreneurial stories. And before I started interviewing Laura that summer, and I was shaking so hard, I should not have been shaking at all. And unbeknownst to me, she had sworn off anthologies forever because she doesn't like doing
that was
it. She had just
right after dispatches.
Right after dispatches, yes. And I pitched this idea to her, and she took 1 second of another anthology, and then she went, "Why, yeah, let's talk about it." And we went on for the other interview for the nonprofit, but. That's how Soul Jar was born, was me like shaking because I was so nervous to ask her about it because, you know, she could say no. And then I'd have to take it to someone I didn't know as well as Laura. I should not have ever doubted her. She is amazing. She's also disabled herself. And she was like, yes, another anthology. Yes. and
I know they're a lot of work, but I think they're among her best-selling titles, too.
I would agree.
We did an interview for City of Weird, which I think was 6-7 years ago, just strange stories about Portland, set in Portland. And then, of course, Dispatches from Inaris, the Le Guin tribute, and now Soul Jar.
Yeah.
I want to talk about the title, too, Annie. It's a term used in one of the stories in the book, Delbrot Peace Warrior, by Holly Sakey. And in Holly's story, a Soul Jar is described as a phylactery, holding the title character's soul, and it gave anyone who held the soul jar power over the title character, Delbrot. Why did you pick this as the book's title? I actually did a little research on it, and it's not new to this story.
No, it wasn't the original title of the story. I wanted something that was, oh gosh, what was the original? Galactic embodiment? No. It was something like that. Like, boy, why am I spacing on it now? I was so hardcore on this title. And Laura kind of KO'd it almost immediately. Celestial embodiment. That's what it was. I was so, like, I had it in my head. Like, this book is going to be called Celestial Embodiment. Because
she probably had good taste about that. To me, it kind of sounds like a soap.
Yes. And she was like, well, that's an okay title, I guess. And I was like, and then we were going through the stories together. We were starting to kind of arrange them after they had all been edited and copy edited. And she had just read Del Brott again. And she was like, Holly talks about a soul jar in this book. And I think that that could be taken so many different ways. Like, the book is a soul jar. It holds a lot of people's souls in it. All of our authors put their soul into this book. What is a soul? How do we hold it in our bodies? How do disabled people have souls too? Sometimes people don't think that, but we do. You know, and in this case, it could be taken away from Del Brott because it was in a container, and that is a sort of a metaphor for our lives not being ours. And that's for a lot of marginalized voices. So she kind of said, what about this? And I went, oh, yes.
Yeah.
Why,
it's
yes.
A great title.
It's such a good title because it can mean a lot of different things to a lot of different people. And does it apply specifically to science fiction or fantasy? No, not necessarily. But in this case, it does. And it's catchy and it's short, which is what you really want in a title. You
with
want
a
something catchy.
To it.
And, yeah, right. Like, oh, and for our subtitle, we always had 31 Fantastical Tales by Disabled Authors. We always had some version of that because we wanted it also to be snappy and we wanted people to wonder, fantastical tales? What kind of fantastical tales are we discussing here? You know, and we didn't want to give too much away about the anthology other than this is a love letter to the disabled community. And so that's kind of how the title sort of originated. It was definitely Laura, though, who picked the title. And I was trying not to pout that Celestial Embodiment wasn't picked. But then we worked together on the different sections. So we have four sections in the anthology: Earth in Retrograde, Gone Astray, Wild Space, and Creature Feature. And I struggled with the organization of this book because I had all these stories that I wanted to make sure everyone got primetime location. This book is primetime location, let's put it that way. But I also thought that we definitely had stories that
had common themes or plots,
yes,
or characters.
Yes, some were in space, some had cereal box toy demons.
that would be a creature feature.
That is definitely a creature feature. And then Gone Astray, sort of lost in the woods, more fantasy. That Del Brott lives there. Other stories live there. And then Earth in Retrograde. So stories that are more, I'm using air quotes again, contemporary, possibly contemporary, that maybe take place in the not too distant future.
A lot of them have apocalypses there.
Yes.
Probably from the pandemic.
Yes.
There are some viruses.
And actually, Nicola's story that we feature we have five reprints in there, and hers is one of them. Because she was working on Meanwood when we approached her to do the foreword and said, if you have a reprint, you can send that in as well if it fits in with the themes. And so hers is about an apocalyptic virus. Well, illness that rampages the world. There's also, Survivors Club by Megan Bowdry, that is about more specifically a COVID-like virus that is really extreme and terrifying. And COVID is extreme and terrifying. So we have a few of those in here. We also have Spore Bud, Bloody Orchid by Jay Viner. That is a story of cancer. I'm a cancer survivor of 15 years. So that was actually a hard story for me to read because I see my oncologist once a year. Whenever I do, it's a moment of deep inhale.
You're on pins and needles.
Right.
Up until you get that word.
Right.
It's in remission.
Yeah, we're still good. You're still good.
Yeah, I want to get to some of the stories in particular. Simon's your first. We mentioned your bio in the book that says you're a lover of romance novels. Mm-hmm. And your story, The Weight of Grief, has a touch of romance, but also a lot of mythology. The narrator, Oliver Cadence, loses his husband, Ezra, to a snake bite. And this takes place in your home state, Arizona, where they have poisonous snakes. And after Ezra dies, Oliver makes his way to a secret courtroom where he appears before two women necromancers. He wants their help to get Ezra back. They ask for payment, and he agrees to sing for them. So the story mirrors the myth of Orpheus, a great poet and musician who travels to the underworld to reclaim his wife, Eurydice, who also died from a snake bite, though probably not in Arizona. And I was wondering what attracts you to this myth, which might be one of the most enduring of romance stories.
Yeah, there's a lot that attracts me to Greek mythology in general. I find a lot of it really fascinating because you can see people who... A lot of religious tales are like, so many people aren't flawed at all. And in Orpheus and Eurydice, there are flaws there. Orpheus is not a good husband, and such like that in the original myth. And so for my story, the reason I picked it for Soul Jar is because when you have someone who just understands you so deeply and on that level that Orpheus and Eurydice do, that you become your own little world. And I think in disability circles, people who are disabled naturally have a higher understanding of each other than somebody who isn't. And I notice that a lot when I'm like around my friends. Most of us are disabled in some form, where I can be like, oh, I really need to sit, or I need to find somewhere to sit. And they're immediately like, yeah, let's go do that, or we can go home. And
there's an understanding that is lacking in somebody who's not disabled.
Yeah. And so when you lose that, there is just emptiness. And my dad was autistic. That's where I get it from. And he passed away when I was 14 or so. Mm. So I pulled from that grief to write the story. And so it was like, I don't know, my mom is not autistic. I love her very much. But we struggled a lot on that because the way that she wanted me to react to things is not how I react to things. And so there was always that like kind of, I don't want to call it a force field, but almost like a more malleable kind of form of it, where we have now gotten to a point where we can understand each other for the most part, but there's still things where it's like, if I had dad around, I think he would like just be like, okay, yeah.
Because he could put himself in your place.
And, yeah.
Yeah, that understanding. It also made me think myths were kind of the fantastical tales of their time, the science fiction and fantasy. When you talk about a story like this, it was a way of explaining the world, of our role in the world and who we were through these, I think, fictional characters. Yeah.
Spoiler alert, it still is. It's what Soul Jar is.
Right. Now, Ellis, your story in the collection is titled Suffer the Silence, a very mysterious story and a powerful one. The narrator is schizophrenic and is taking refuge in an overgrown city park, what he describes as a city park gone feral. I love that phrase. He hears a baby crying, doesn't know where the baby is, and meets a woman who wants help finding her baby. We're never sure if this is real or an hallucination, a product of the schizophrenia. The story, I think you mentioned you were bipolar, so it had some roots in your own experience?
Sort of. So bipolar type 1, you get the type 1 diagnosis if you ever have an episode of psychosis, or if it ever gets so bad that you need hospitalization. And I used schizophrenia here as a shorthand for the type of psychosis that bipolar 1 can have, because it's more readily accessible for general audiences. I was not trying to step on anybody's toes, but I was trying to make it more accessible for people. And it's actually based on the Southwestern legend and Mexican legend of La Llorona, which is...
Oh, there was a horror movie about that, wasn't there?
I mean, there's a lot of
probably a lot, yeah.
And it plays on the Greek myth of Medea, a woman who drowns her own baby and then it needs to find the baby again and can't find the baby. And the title because I did focus more on the psychosis aspect of hearing things that maybe weren't real, I was going with the dual meaning of the word suffer, which can either mean to endure or allow for the silence. But yeah, I've only ever really had one truly bad episode, and I was really pulling heavily from that episode, and it was about 10 years ago now, but it is what solidified my proper diagnosis.
Was that therapeutic at all, cathartic, to write the story?
Sort of. I'm going to say yes, only because when I finish it, it still makes me cry a little bit. So I think that that's a sign of a good story. A good therapeutic story is if you can cry and you know how it ends and you still are a little bit weepy at the end of it. And Annie's nodding, so I think she's probably experienced this once or twice.
Yeah.
But just there was a lot of therapy also in how the main character reacts to the mother, who is clearly... He can hear this baby. Why can't she hear it?
Right.
He could hear. Why? What kind of mother loses her baby in the first place? Clearly, this, you know, it's. And he's upset because this was his quiet place. This was his refuge. Why is there. Who the heck brings a baby to his quiet place? You know, that's what.
And I think because of its place in the book on fantastical tales, we're never quite sure if he's experienced something that's actually happening. Or if it's all in his head, you know, being schizophrenic. Mm-hmm. And that worked really well when I was reading it, that balance you have in there. Well, you know, a lot of skill, a lot of craft went into that.
Well, thank you very, very much. I think that it definitely falls closer to the horror end of the speculative spectrum.
Especially, well, I shouldn't give it away. So
that's okay. That's
some of the last images in the book, but it will creep you out.
I will say this. This is an interesting moment for me, to be perfectly honest, because Alice's story was the second one I selected during submissions, and Simon's story was the second to last one that I selected. And for a while, it came in on the last day of submissions. And then Carol's story about hearing aids in the apocalypse was the very last one that I said yes to. And then we were like, and scene! So I find it really like how both of your stories were like just the positioning of them in the submissions, and when I said yes, and when I said yes to both of you, is really mirroring. And they also seemed not similar in any way, but in my mind they are kind of similar. They both deal with grief. They both deal with a fantastical moment, like, am I really seeing this? Am I really seeing these women who can maybe bring back my partner? Am I really seeing this baby? I don't know. So in my mind, like, the two of you are linked. And so when you both signed up to do the interview today, I was like, yeah, that's cool. Okay.
Clearly it was meant to be.
Yeah, and we're in the same section in the book.
You are, yeah.
When I got that acceptance letter, I was absolutely just flabbergasted. I keep track of submissions through the Grindr, the submission Grindr, which is where I found the call in the first place.
Yeah.
And usually for submissions, you know, you set it out and you wait, you know, 4 to 6 weeks or 4 to forever to hear back.
I've heard some stories from writers.
It was like 10 days or something. It was just, and I was expecting a rejection, because you never get a turnaround that fast. I was so shocked and so grateful to be accepted.
Yeah, a lot of the stories, I've had sort of the same story from the authors, and I think that that's very indicative of being a disabled writer in our society, and our publishing society especially is very gatekeepy about certain stories and how they can be told and how they can't be told. So a lot of the authors, when I was like, hey, your story is amazing, I had one author who was like, I have been trying to get this story placed somewhere for a very long time. And I had kind of lost hope for this story. And it's one, I mean, I keep saying this. It's one of my favorite stories. Every single story in this anthology is my favorite story. But when I read it, I was like, I need this immediately. You know, I hope that no one else snatches it up before the submission, end of submissions, you know. And they didn't, thankfully, and it's in here.
Probably, but one of the reasons why you didn't see stories like this before Soul Jar.
Yeah,
before this change.
Yes, exactly.
Hopefully a change in culture.
Here's hoping. It's a pebble in the pond, but we know that pebbles in ponds have ripples. And I will say, at the most recent PNBA trade show I was at in September, it was, congratulations, both of you. It was selected. It basically got a bookseller award. It was the buzz book of the show, which the booksellers vote on. There's 8 different books that are in the running. And it won, I guess, by a landslide.
Wow. and that's a tough audience.
It's a tough audience.
They're not
booksellers.
Looking for the enjoyment of it, but if they can sell it to their customers.
Well, there's, yes, enjoyment, yes. But because we, speaking as a bookseller and a bookstore owner in this case, I love trade shows because I get to go and I get to see all the upcoming books and I'm really excited about it, to know about what's upcoming, but also to read it myself. So yes and yes and no. That's kind of a complicated way to put it, in that we are all very excited about reading. There's a reason we're booksellers. And we are excited to tell our customers about our new favorite books that we've been reading. So yeah, the fact that the booksellers, thank you all booksellers who are at PNBA and selected Soul Jar as the buzz book of the show. When they announced it at the dinner that evening, I cried, and my friend Madison at Saltwater Bookshop caught it on video. She was at the next table over.
I got her phone and just started videoing.
Yes!
Like a true friend really would.
Yes, absolutely, yeah.
I'd like to mention one other story that Simon and Ellis didn't write. but it kind of brings up something that you guys were saying before about the attempt to fit in when you were growing up. This is called A Peril of Being Human by Julie Reeser, is the writer. The narrator's a therapist, but also a shapeshifter. And she changes her shape to identify more and appease her clients and even the people she just meets. Mm-hmm. So she goes on a date with a fellow shapeshifter, which she didn't know at the time, named Malcolm. They kind of discover that they're both can do this. They have this power. And they decide not to do that, to please the others, which seems to me like the plight of many disabled people, whether to accommodate others' views on them, however prejudiced or incorrect, and change accordingly, or try to, or just be who they are, to live their truth. And it's a question for all of you. Is that choice something you faced growing up disabled?
Yes.
Yeah, I think for sure. And I think lately I've been doing a lot of work on learning how to be okay with being physically disabled visibly. Because I just got my cane during the pandemic. I got it in 2021 fall, I think. And that was like a big learning curve. And I didn't use it all the time. I still don't use it all the time. I don't need it all the time. But I've learned if I'm leaving the house, I'm going to bring it anyway, just in case. And that's something that I didn't do. And before I got it, I had this thing where every time I had an umbrella and it wasn't raining, I would use it as a cane. That's not how you're supposed to use umbrellas. Don't recommend it. It will ruin your umbrella. but every time I did, I was like, this is so fun. I love doing this. This feels good. But I don't need a cane. And I did that for several years, I think, where I was like, I don't need it. It's just fun to use an umbrella like one sometimes. And then I got one and I was like, it feels like I have a wizard staff and it hurts less. This is amazing.
Yeah, I will jump in and say, so as mentioned, I've had I have a few disabilities, including a vasculitis diagnosis, which is an autoimmune disorder. It's dormant. My diagnosis is dormant, but it's it can flare if I don't take care of myself. And so as a child and a teenager, for example, I would have surgery. I had the bulk of my surgical procedures between the ages of 2 and 16. Since then, I've had a few more. My cesarean for my son in 2016 was my 20th surgical procedure. But as a teenager and young adult tween, I think we call them now. We didn't have that word when I was a tween. But I would come to school in a wheelchair or with crutches, and suddenly I was cool, I'm air quoting again. And kids would take my wheelchair or push me in my wheelchair, or they'd take my crutches and run away with them, you know, because they wanted to play with them. And this was in like junior high, uh-huh. when kids are starting to try to be more independent and adult-like. And then they would forget about me, and my wheelchair would be like across the school, or my crutches would be like across the classroom, and I couldn't get to them because I had a hip cast and I wasn't supposed to put weight on whatever leg I had just had surgery on.
They thought you were just pretending that you needed
a wheelchair. Well, no, I don't think so. Yeah. I think that they just thought it was fun. And I was like a side note in that story. I got really good. I love this story because it is also a lot about masking that I think every disabled person and people outside of the disability community know how to do, where they have a face for different situations. So I have a bookstore owner face. I have an author event face, which may be on right now, you know, and it takes work. I have a really great therapist. It takes work to let that mask go and just be myself. And so at a young age, I was taught, and this is not grooming is the wrong word, but it is kind of training by medical professionals. I like to joke that when I was a child, I never threw temper tantrums when I was in the hospital, because then I got the good Jell-O and the good pudding. And the nurses like would come when I hit my nurse call button. Whereas if you throw a temper tantrum because you're scared out of your mind because you're 8 and you've just had this huge traumatic surgery, they don't respond as well. Even at Seattle Children's Hospital, which is an amazing hospital, they hire amazing people there. But you kind of learn at an early age to be a people pleaser, to have a mask on.
You're rewarded to mask.
Yes, basically. And it has taken a lot of work to kind of work my way out of that. And I still do it all the time. And Ellis.
I was going to say, there's a kids movie out now on Netflix called Nimona.
Yes.
I'm glad everybody else is on the same
it's
page.
It's based on a comic book. Everyone should read it. And I'm bookselling right now.
I associate it more with the transgender community personally, mm-hmm. but it
definitely.
Is about a shape-shifting girl who is constantly having to pretend to be a girl, because when she is shape-shifting, and she calls it shifting shapes, feels like getting rid of an itch between your shoulder blades.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And it doesn't hurt. It's just like that moment right before you sneeze, and it's just like a release. But she's considered a monster, and people don't want her around. And there's all sorts of games around monster killing and stuff. And I can't watch it with my kids anymore. They love it. They love that movie. And it's a wonderful movie.
It hits you in a certain way?
It
or?
Hits me. I'm also a trans man. I don't usually advertise it because I pass really well. So I've got a lot of what's the word I'm looking for here?
We're all writers here, and oftentimes we can't actually form words.
They're so hard.
Words are hard.
I get a lot of benefit out of passing. I pass really well. Thank you. Privilege. I get a lot of privilege out of passing.
Yeah.
So I don't often advertise it, but being a trans person and knowing how well or how hated that community can be, it's very hard for me to watch. And my and even though it's a wonderful movie and it's got a lot of really good messages, and the messages are all the correct ones for children, especially children my children's age who are 4 and 6, I can't watch it because it's
just watching what
Numona's going through. It's too hard for me. But it's all about masking, and it's all about hiding what you are and or who you are, and so that you're not hated or not hurt. And it works for any minority. Yeah. I really associate it more transgender just because literally it's talking about transition between
Julie's story. Yeah, in Soul Jar, Julie's story, The Perils of Being Human, is very purposeful about that as well, and is purposeful about how I think everyone does it a little bit, masks who they are. I mean, and we kind of do because we have like our work persona and our home persona. And
exactly.
But certain communities are forced to do it more often and to a greater extent, I think, than others. For example, I am a cishet white woman. My only marginalized community is disabilities. I had great healthcare growing up. I have great healthcare now. I mean, you know, I still have to fight with my insurance company to get the great healthcare, but I am not turned away because I'm a person of color or I'm trans or I'm gay. I am very privileged in that respect. And I still mask so hard sometimes. Just because I don't have an invisible disability, I am very obviously disabled. And when I walk by a window or a mirror, I'm like, "Woo, I am disabled. Look at that." And that has never stopped being the case. Like, I see the way I walk. When I walk normally to myself. And Nisi at the Elliott Bay Book event was really cool about saying, well, we're all normal in our own way, because I was like, well, no one is normal. And she quickly pivoted that, which I think was really great. But for me, this is my normal. And then I walk by a mirror or a window, like I said, and I'm like, wow, no wonder people think I'm disabled. You know, that and the bald head and the shunt and the everything else. There are certain communities that are told point blank through our society and through media and through our stories that we absolutely need to hide ourselves because we are not liked. There's a lot of trans hate going on right now, which I have so many issues about. So many issues. I don't understand why people can't just be people and who they are. I'm allowed to be who I am sometimes.
It's a fear of the other, I think.
It is a fear of the other, and it's no one else's business, really.
Yeah, you used the term normal. I did an interview with another Forest Avenue Press author, Zaji Cox.
Yes, I love Zaji.
And she's neurodivergent. I did some research on it. Actually, the term's only about 25 years old, but it was developed by a social scientist. She wanted to make people know that there's really no such thing as normal.
No.
There's difference.
There is,
In terms of neurodivergence and masking, there's something that I think is really interesting as a phenomenon, and talking about how society normalizes it and kind of rewards being good. A phrase I heard a lot growing up that I'm sure Annie will relate to this as being part of that, like, reward and being a gifted kid is, "You're so mature for your age."
Oh my God. Yes. Did you hear this too, Ellis?
I'm the oldest.
Yes, same.
And I don't know if you have any siblings.
I don't know.
But being the oldest or being female at birth, you have different expectations placed upon you.
Yes.
And so you hide a lot of things early on.
Yeah.
And
You're so mature for your age. Yeah, a lot of that.
Yeah, and there's also the flip side of that I'm learning now. And I heard this phrase from somebody, I can't remember who it was, but they talked about it. And I was like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
Because since transitioning, I'm like, well, I already don't know how to mask, so I might as well, like,
go for it.
It's too hard to mask.
Why?
But something I do is I carry stuffed animals around with me. I have this little stuffed crochet shark that my friend made me, because sharks are one of my special interests. And it's a really good texture. I rub it on my face when I'm anxious and stuff. But what's really interesting is leaning into who I am and who Like, I really like sharks. My bedroom at home, that is, there's sharks in there, and it's great. It makes me really happy. But something on the flip side of you're so mature for your age is you get to be older, an adult, and you're like, okay, I'm allowed to be who I am. And then you become childish.
Mm-hmm.
Because at that point, well, you're an adult. Why are you carrying stuffed animals around? Why? Like, and I have had people go, that's really cool. I love that you have a stuffed animal. Like, that's super cool. I've never really had a negative to it. But I have had negatives to, like, why is your bedroom shark themed? I'm like, it brings me joy. And I like that. And why shouldn't I be happy when I'm in my room? That also is where I write my stories. Like, I should be able to be happy.
Yeah, you get past a certain age, you're not allowed to do that anymore.
No.
Yeah, that doesn't really make sense.
I read an article recently about this phenomenon, how men are allowed to have, like, for example, Star Wars figurines, right?
Yes.
And models that they paint or Legos that they build. But women and female presenting are not. And if we do, we're very childish. I have so many Legos friends. We just went to Legoland a few weeks ago, and I picked up a TIE Fighter Lego set. I am so excited for it. Let me just put that in there.
Yeah, his bedroom was full of those.
Yeah, for men.
Lego Star Wars.
Yeah, men, that's okay. And this is, like, really segregating genders here, which I hate doing. But the article did that, and how when women do it, we're very childish, and we're seeing it. I collect stuffed animals. I love stuffed animals. That is, like, the gift that you get when you're in the hospital post-op, and I loved it. I loved it so much. I still collect stuffed animals. I still have – anytime we go somewhere like the aquarium – and my kid is like, Mommy, can I get a toy? And I'm like, only if Mommy gets a toy. You know, it's like, why not? Yeah.
Well, Annie Ellis and Simon, I wanted to thank you so much for coming into Kabu today, for sharing your stories, for the book, and for not masking, for being yourself.
We did our best.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ken, for having us. Thank you for reaching out and wanting to discuss this. I think, my opinion only, but I think this book is incredibly important and really needed in our culture, in society, and as representation of what disabled authors have to say about fantasy and science fiction in the future and where we belong in it, which is right in the middle of it. Thank you.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah.
Well, that's all for this episode of Jonesy here on KABU Community Radio. If you missed any part of the show, would like to hear the longer, unexpurgated version, the director's cut you might call it if we had one, you could listen anytime on demand at kboo.fm/program/Jonesy, J-O-N-E-S-Y, or just search for it on the KABU website. Before we head out the door, a big thank you to our guest today, Annie Carl, editor, and Ellis Bray and Simon Quinn, contributors to the new anthology Soul Jar, 31 fantastical tales by disabled authors from Forest Avenue Press. You can learn more about the book online at forestavenuepress.com and more about Annie's never-ending bookshop in Edmonds, Washington at theneverendingbookshop.com. Jonesy, by the way, comes to you every other week on the second and fourth Thursdays of the month from 11 to 11:30 a.m. Tune in for our next show on Thursday, November 23rd at 11 a.m. I'm your host, Ken Jones, no relation, saying hope to see you all again then.